the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, every day in this country, 10,000 Americans retire heading into those golden years. The real question is, how many of them are prepared for it? According to recent studies, not too many. Joining me on the program as my special guest is Jonathan Clements. He's a financial writer. He's author of the Jonathan Clements Money Guide and an upcoming book this September, How to Think About Money. Jonathan, it seems like every single year now, we're starting to get various studies that are sort of analyzing everybody that's heading into retirement. It's probably the largest retirement generation that we've seen as boomers head into those golden years. But according to these surveys, those golden years aren't going to be so golden. So let's talk about the results of this survey, because I guess there's some good news and some bad news about it.
So every year, the Employee Benefit Research Institute, which is a think tank in Washington, D.C., does this retirement confidence survey. And it's based on, you know, talking to people in the workforce and in retirement to see how financially prepared they are. And the numbers are not inspiring. For instance, one of the things they found was that among workers, 26% of workers say they have $100,000 or more of savings. That's a good sign. But 26% say they have less than $1,000 in savings. 26% have less than $1,000 in savings.
Wow.
And this is a number that you've seen in other surveys. For instance, another survey found that many Americans would essentially be on the breadline within 2 weeks of losing their job because they have so little financial savings. They have no sort of emergency fund. And clearly, this is a big issue for us as a country. We have, you know, millions of people heading towards retirement in a world where traditional defined benefit pensions have largely disappeared. Most people are not going to retire and receive a check every month for the rest of their life from their employer. So what will they have? They will have Social Security, though even that is under threat, and whatever little savings they have. And as we've learned, the amount of savings is really very small.
Jonathan, is a lot of this having to do with the fact that over the last three decades, we've seen more and more of the Fortune 500, S&P 500 companies really move away from defined benefit pension plans? I'm thinking back to the World War II generation that, you know, dad worked for a company for 30 years. He got his Timex watch, but he got a defined benefit pension plan. They usually covered 70 to 80% of his salary. You threw in Social Security on top of that, and they pretty much had a secure retirement. So is it the removal of defined benefit pension plans as the norm for corporations that has been behind much of this?
There's no doubt, Jim, that that is a big part of the problem. But layered on top of that are a number of other things that have been going on. I mean, first of all, life expectancies are increasing. So it's not simply that, you know, people no longer have traditional defined benefit pensions, and instead they have to save the money themselves, but the retirement that they need to cover is getting longer and longer. If you're age 65 today and you're a man, you know, you're looking on average at a retirement that might last 19 years. If you're a woman, you're looking at a retirement that might last 22 years. That is substantially longer than it was just 30 years ago. So people need to have significant nest eggs heading into retirement. Those Fortune 500 companies that have been shedding their traditional defined benefit pension plans have been replacing them with so-called 401k plans, where it's up to the employee to contribute. Often the employer will also put in some money, but their contribution is a matching contribution. So for you to get your employer's money, you have to put in money of your own. There were two shocking surveys that came out last year, one from Financial Engines and the other from Vanguard. And what those two surveys found was that somewhere between a quarter and a third of all employees failed to put enough in their 401k plan to get the full employer matching contribution. What these employees are doing is essentially throwing away free money. All they had to do was put money into their plan and they would get a matching contribution from their employer that might be worth 50 cents for every dollar they contributed. And yet, because they didn't put in that dollar, they didn't get the 50 cents.
Jonathan, how much is this a matter or an issue of education or let's say inflation, because, you know, we hear so much in the news today about wages remaining stagnant. And I know a lot of families are struggling to make it. It takes both a husband and wife working today to make ends meet. So how much of this has to do with inflation, or how much of this is just a matter of education and being informed?
So you mentioned two things there, Jim. One, education, and two, what's happened to wages. And I think the answer is all of the above. If you go back to the 1990s, the model for the 401k plan was you give employees a bunch of educational materials, you give them a wide range of investment choices, and good things will happen. What we discovered was if you give people a lot of educational material and you give them a lot of investment choices, they freeze. Paralysis sets in and they do nothing. So one of the things the 401k plans have been trying to do is to guide employees towards better decisions. That means limiting the number of investment choices and changing the default investment option. It used to be if you didn't make an investment choice, you would be put into the money market fund. Now you'll be put into one of these target date retirement funds. Target date retirement funds aren't ideal, but they do give you essentially a well-diversified portfolio in a single mutual fund. It's a good choice for a lot of people, particularly those who are not educated enough to make sound investment decisions on their own. But even with those improvements, you know, we still see a lot of people not contributing to 401k plans. And I think what you mentioned about wages is indeed an issue. But it's not that wages, you know, are actually shrinking in many cases. This is just they're not rising at the pace they used to. And what this sets up is essentially a situation where those people with lower incomes are looking around and seeing that, you know, a lot of people are getting the latest iPhone. They've got a full array of cable channels. They have been able to take advantage of all these improvements in quality of life that we have here in the U.S. People on lower incomes want those things as well. They see them on the TV. They see the advertisements. And as a consequence, consumption has gone up and savings rates have gone down. You go back to the 1980s, people regularly saved 10% of income. Today, people are saving at half that level. So yeah, the stagnant wages combined with the allure of spending has helped to drive down the savings rate and create this retirement savings crisis that we have.
How much of this also has to do with proper investment choices? Because I know when I got in the business, Jonathan, we were taught dollar cost averaging. So let's say you're an employee working for a company, you're young. Let's say you're in your 20s, 30s, or even 40s. So every single paycheck, you put money into your retirement plan. Now, of course, we've had two major bear markets, which have scared a lot of people out of stocks. But Jonathan, the whole idea of dollar cost averaging is during the years that the markets are going through a downturn, as we did between, let's say, 2007 and 2009, every single month that money goes into a stock fund, that money is buying more shares with that money because the shares are cheaper. So the only thing that really matters is 25, 30 years from now is how many shares you have. But people don't think like that anymore. And I think that's an issue of education as well. It's not just the fact that it's individuals not saving enough. It's also improper investing given their age.
I couldn't agree with you more, Jim. I mean, you go back to late 2008 and early 2009. And to my mind, you know, that was the investment opportunity of my lifetime. You know, that was my big chance to invest and earn serious investment gains. But unfortunately, a lot of people didn't view it that way. You know, they viewed it as the end of the financial world, you know, is at hand. And instead of getting into stocks, they were getting out. And to some degree, it's understandable. I mean, you know, the 2007 to 2009 market decline, you know, which saw the S&P 500 drop 57%, you know, followed hot on the heels of the 2000 to 2002 decline, which saw share prices drop 49%. You know, it was our second huge bear market in a dozen years. And for a lot of people, that was an unnerving prospect. But the fact is, you know, our investment time horizon is not measured in years. It's not measured in 5 years. It's not measured in 10 years. It's measured in decades and decades. If you're in your 20s today, you know, you might be looking at living until your early 90s. You've got a seven-decade investment time horizon. That is plenty of time to ride out these rough spells in the stock market and earn decent gains. And yet, You know, there's something about the way our brains are wired that when we see the market decline, you know, we're gripped by that fear of loss. And instead of adding to our stock portfolios, we tend to bail out.
How much of this can be solved, Jonathan? For example, if the company is large enough, the HR department puts on retirement seminars. In other words, educating the employee in terms of the benefits of the company, whether they have a 401k program, matching contributions, or even, for example, some kind of counseling when it comes to investment advice. Because I think, you know, one of the issues that you addressed here is a lot of individuals just aren't financially savvy enough to know that, hey, given my age, given my goals and objectives, if they have even some kind of a plan, this is the way I should be investing, so that they focus on the long-term result, which is getting them to retirement, rather than the day-to-day fluctuation or whatever Janet Yellen is saying this week or what the Fed's going to do or whatever worries the market today.
I think one of the things that it's important to recognize is that, you know, investors have all kinds of different abilities. So there are people who are very interested in the financial markets, who educate themselves, who do very well in this 401k world where, you know, the entire burden of decision-making is on their shoulders. You know, they know they need to save. They have some sense for how to build a reasonably well-diversified portfolio. But for many people, and my hunch is the majority, you know, they do not have the knowledge or even the inclination to learn this stuff. And what we need to do is to somehow give them, you know, a break, something that's going to keep them invested at times of market turmoil, you know, whether it's a person they can talk to or, you know, a system that, you know, forces them to wait, you know, 5 days before they make a sale, you know, something that maybe compels them when they make an investment to agree that they're going to hold that investment for at least 5 years, some forcing mechanism that will keep them invested at times of market turmoil. You know, once people have been through a bear market and invested through it and seen that you come out the other side and you can make good money, I think that person is a changed investor. But many people, you know, never learn that lesson because they panic, because they don't understand what's going on. And it's really unfortunate. And it's unfortunate because it has real world consequences. What we're talking about, you know, how we began the show was talking about how, you know, we have millions of people heading to retirement whose comfort in retirement is solely on their shoulders. You know, beyond what they're going to get for Social Security, everything else beyond that bare minimum is up to them. And they simply aren't capable of making the right decisions. So these people do need help.
Yeah, the other thing that also strikes me too is in college, you know, we go to get a degree to hopefully help us in earning a living or choosing a profession. But I don't care whether it's medical school or any other type of program, we don't teach people financial planning or how to manage their finances once they get out of college and get a job.
Interesting enough, for the last couple of semesters, I taught a college course on personal finance. And it's fascinating the attitude of the students, you know, when you know, talk to them about what they're concerned about, you know, they have very short time horizons. They're thinking about the car they're going to buy. They're thinking about how they're going to service their student loans. These kids are shocked when I tell them that their top financial priority when they first get into the workforce shouldn't be buying a car. It shouldn't be purchasing that first home. Instead, their top priority should be saving for retirement. You know, as I tell people, you know, chronologically, retirement may be our most distant goal, but in terms of our priorities, it should always be number one. You know, you can take out a loan to buy a house, you can take out a loan to pay for college, but when it comes to retirement, you need to start out with a heaping pile of cash, and that takes decades and decades of diligent saving and investing.
So, Jonathan, given where we are today, we know that entitlements are increasingly taking a larger portion of the federal budget. Some people question, you know, the solvency of Social Security. We know that, for example, Medicare only covers about 60% of medical expenses, which is a problem as many individuals are unaware that they're likely to spend 20 years in retirement, meaning that they're going to have access to funds. And in those latter years, they're going to be shelling out a lot more money for medical. So how do we resolve this issue? Because clearly the government can't do everything and is limited to the extent of what it can promise and deliver.
I think the answer, Jim, is that people have to work longer. Now, when we started out our conversation, we were talking about the Employee Benefit Research Institute study. And one of the things that study found was that 67% of workers expect to work for pay once they're retired, but only 27% of retirees reported doing so. So clearly, a lot of people are thinking about working in retirement, but not many currently are. I think not only will that change, it has to change. We are moving towards a population that is increasingly top-heavy. You know, more and more people are over age 65 relative to those who are of working age. And that simply isn't sustainable from an economic point of view. We cannot have a relatively small number of workers and a huge number of people dependent on their productivity. We need to keep it more in balance. That means that people either need to stay in the workforce for longer or they have to work part-time in retirement. And I think you'll see employers, as they try to maintain a good productive workforce, look to retain workers and look to find ways to offer a part-time work to retirees. And I think this is a good thing. I mean, it's a good thing not simply for the economy, and it's a good thing not simply for the finances of older Americans. I also think it's good for people psychologically. The notion that we should work like dogs for 40 years in order to spend the last 20 years of our lives sitting around and relaxing is ridiculous. Sitting around and relaxing for 20 years does not make for a fulfilling life. Going to work, for a lot of people, gives them a lot of satisfaction. They like the interaction with their coworkers. They like the feeling of being productive. They want to feel like they're doing something important with their lives. I think that a gradual increase in the retirement age and an increased number of people working part-time in retirement would actually be good for society.
Well, we know that people that work longer stay healthier longer. And Jonathan, it goes along with what we've seen with the improvements in medical science. People, as you say, are living longer. When Social Security was put into effect, I think the average life expectancy for a male was 65. Today, it's closer to 85. So it's only natural if we've extended life expectancy by several decades, it would only be natural that people work longer rather than this concept that goes back to the Great Depression. Oh, you retire at age 62 or 65. So isn't it possible, at least some of the things that I've read, that the government is looking at extending the limits for Social Security eligibility? In other words, we know that people are living longer. They're drawing on those benefits for a longer period of time. For us boomers, the age has been extended to 66. Gen X, it's stage 67. What's the possibility, Jonathan, that Social Security gets extended to, let's say, age 68 or 69?
I think it's entirely possible, and I think it makes entire financial sense. One thing that listeners should be aware of is that actually, you know, from a funding point of view, Social Security is not in that much trouble. I mean, the unfunded liability for Social Security is not huge. Instead, the really big issue is Medicare. You know, the unfunded liability for Medicare is something like 10 times larger than the unfunded liability for Social Security. As I tell people, the reason we talk about Social Security is because it's a solvable problem. The issue with Medicare is that the unfunded liability is so large that nobody has any clue what to do. That is the biggest crisis in the making when it comes to Americans in retirement. And the way around it is to keep people in the workforce for longer so that they can pay for their own benefits rather than being reliant on the government. But with all that, I guess I want to mention one caveat. You know, for me as a financial writer, you know, the idea of staying in the workforce for longer is no great burden. I just continue to sit here at my desk and bang away at my laptop. But for some workers who have hard, manual, blue-collar work, you know, staying in the workforce for longer is going to be an issue. And we're going to need to think hard about retraining those workers so that they can have jobs that are sustainable through their 60s. And I think we still need to have Social Security as an option for people who want to take it at 62 and simply do not have the physical ability to work any longer and do need to quit the workforce.
So, Jonathan, as we sum up here, you know, it seems to me there are going to have to be needed changes going forward, whether it's extending the age of Social Security, people considering working longer, staying in the workforce for a longer period of time. But the traditional, oh, you turn age 62, you retire, you collect your check from the government, you collect a check from the company, that world no longer exists. And we're transitioning to a newer world where people are living longer. And as we know, one of the biggest expenses in the latter years of our life is going to be medical. Jonathan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow you, tell them how they could do so, and also tell us a little bit about your new book coming out in September.
If you want to follow my writing, you could just point your browser to jonathanclements.com. I blog on that site once or twice a week. It also has details about the various books I put out and my various other activities. In terms of new books, my next book will be out September 1. It's called How to Think About Money, and it's really a summation of the investment philosophy that I've developed over 31 years of writing and thinking about money. It tackles many of the issues that we've been talking about today, about, you know, the opportunity presented by increasing longevity, some of the mental mistakes we make, how to use your money to buy more happiness, some of the emotional errors that occur. I think for a lot of people, it'll be a great read. So I'm very excited for it to come out.
Jonathan, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Don't be a stranger. Come back and talk to us again, especially when your book comes out. I'd love to talk to you about it after I read it.
It'll be my pleasure, Jim.
You know, Jim, in listening to what you were saying today on the program, what really amazed me, first of all, like you said at the beginning of the show, how is it all of these very wealthy people managed to seemingly pass on all their wealth when you look at the staggering taxes that are being imposed? And then the lifetime example that we used here, the Schwartzes, you were able to actually do that. And so when you have these kinds of monies involved, the trick is to do the plan, follow the things that are available to you, and you can make it work for you. And I was amazed that you could actually do that.
Well, absolutely, John. I mean, how do you think the Rockefellers are around? The Clintons are worth close to $150 million. They have, what have you been hearing in the news? The Clinton Foundation. I mean, all these people use these tools. I mean, they were set and influenced by lobbyists. The tragedy here is the people that don't do the planning or procrastinate, like in the case of Prince. There's $100 million is going to go out to the door and be spent worthlessly by the government when it could have been put to good use. So you're absolutely right. But these tools have been around, John, since they came up with income taxes and estate taxes going back to early on in the last century. And they're still being used today. And there's so many variations. The point that we're making here, there's no reason why you should be paying capital gains and estate taxes. You simply shouldn't if you do proper planning.
Chris, one would ask under a logical question is, then why do we bother to impose this stuff at all? Because obviously these Congress critters over the years have left loopholes so people could climb through them.
Well, that's why you have lobbyists. That's the lobbyist's job, because lobbyists solicit on behalf of their clients who contribute to politicians' campaigns, and the loopholes are put in place to benefit the people that contribute to politicians. John, it's the way the system works.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, that's the way it is.
Well, the point is, those laws are put there. They're legitimate. They're on the book. People are using them all the time. You don't think the Clintons, you don't think the Obamas are going to be using this? They all do, because they're all aware of it. Because when you get to that size money, you know, that's what happens. You're able to hire tax attorneys and tax accountants and shelter from government confiscation. Well, in the meantime, well, we're out of time as usual. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.